Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and take a look at the two events coming up. Those are in Bentonville, Arkansas in April. That's the Here We Still Stand regional event, two-day event. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people. It's going to be a great time. If you live anywhere around the Ozarks, you should come down. And even if you don't, you've never been to the Ozarks, or if you have been to the Ozarks and you want to come back, get on a plane, get in the car, drive on down. 2 days, hang out with us. It's going to be a good time. That's in April. It's only $65 to go to that event, and it's going to be a really cool, fun time. So check out that. And then also we have the National Conference in October, and you want to get on the early bird special for tickets for that. So you want to make sure you register before the first of the year so you can get in on the lowest price possible. Go to one, but really go to both. You know what I'm saying? You want to go to both if you can swing it. You haven't been doing much in 2020. You've been cooped up. 2021 is the year you go to both conferences. Chad, what's going on, man?
I feel like I'm still recovering from Thanksgiving. What has it been? This is like 5 days after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I ate way too much, like 3 days in a row. So I feel like I've been in a food coma like the last week or so. Just same old, same old.
Yeah.
Just living the life between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It kind of gets crazy this time of year.
Yeah, it was Thanksgiving was a little different for me this year. It was small. We kept it small because we had some family members that had, they didn't have the Rona, but they got exposed to it, and you know, we're trying to be safe, so we didn't assemble the. So it was a little bit smaller thing, but all that meant was that you cooked like the same amount of food that you would like normally cook for like way more people, because you don't know how to like reduce the size of the recipe or something. And so this was a horrible thing for me for a couple of days, where there's just like way too much food for not nearly enough people.
Yeah, my problem is my dad's a diabetic, so I try not to eat too many sweets, but I also love sweets. And if there's sweets in the house, yeah, I'm like an addict. I mean, I just like, I can't, like two times a day I'm having a piece of pie or something like that. So yeah, the desserts were the temptation that I could not stay away from. So I enjoyed myself for a few days with the sweets. Yeah, but they're all gone now, so I'm back to healthy eating, at least for a couple weeks.
Yeah, before that cycle is about to repeat itself.
Yeah, start all over again. Yeah. Yep.
Well, we left off in an interesting spot in the life of David and Saul. David is getting praise upon praise from everyone. Everyone loves David. Very popular guy. Saul, you know, made David the sort of commander of his armies, because Saul is pragmatic enough to see that David is a courageous dude, even if he feels a little suspicious of him. But he might be regretting that now, as all of Israel is fawning all over David. And we sort of ended with Saul, as the ESV translated, eyeing David from that point on.
Yeah, and things are going to fall apart quite rapidly after that, in fact. Yeah, so we have the whole David and Goliath episode, and then Jonathan and David are best friends, and yeah, I mean, it sort of seems like everything might work itself out. But then you have that ninth verse about him eyeing David, looking upon him with suspicion. And then immediately at verse 10, things fall apart. So it says that the next day, they're, I guess, at Saul's house. And David's there, and Saul's there, and David is playing the lyre or the harp, whatever it might be. The Hebrew actually doesn't say it. It just says he was playing with his hand, meaning playing some instrument with his hand. And all of a sudden, it says an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, or rushed upon Saul, as some translations have it. So this is the same thing that we encountered, what was that, back in chapter 17, when they first brought David on, when they first brought him to the palace, so that he could play the harp or play the lyre and soothe Saul during these troubling times. So once more, we have this evil spirit from God and it comes upon Saul, and it says he was raving in the midst of the house. Now, I think every translation I checked has raving. The Hebrew is actually prophesying, but they translate it as raving because of kind of this, whatever's going on with Saul, you know, whether it's some sort of mental illness or this divinely caused trauma that's happening with him, whatever it is, he is soothed for a while and then he'll lose it again. So he's raving slash prophesying, however you want to translate that, but it's some sort of kind of frenzied, frantic kind of losing his mind kind of actions that are happening. And we know that because of what he's going to do next. So this evil spirit comes upon him. He raves or prophesies in his house. David's playing. And we have a interesting thing going on here in the Hebrew, because it says that David was playing with his hand, his yod. And then it says that Saul had a spear in his yod, in his hand. So we have the scene set up with two different things. One has an instrument in his hand, and then one has a spear in his hand. And what's he going to do? Well, verse 11 says that Saul hurled the spear because he said to himself, he thought, I will pin David to the wall. Another kind of interesting thing about the Hebrew here, that word for pin is the same word that is used back in that song that you referred to earlier, Dan, about Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. The word for the verb for slain is the same one that's used here for pin. So it's like, I will strike, more or less. So I will strike David to the wall. And basically the spear is going to go through him and stick in the wall. But it says David escaped from his presence twice.
This is a crazy two verses, right? I mean, they had a lot packed in here. I mean, so you got a harmful spirit or an evil spirit from God, which of course I would say is God is allowing for something to spiritually torment Saul. If you actually put the scene together, it seems that Saul is raving around the house. David's like playing, trying to calm him down. You have a guy, it doesn't say that he picked up a spear. It says that David's playing and he just has a spear. So in my mind, Saul is just roaming around the house, ranting and raving with a spear in his hand, while David's playing the lyre or the harp or whatever. This is a tense scene right here, right? I mean, if you're David, that's intense. I mean, this guy, you're like, this guy's losing it. He's walking around with a spear, talking crazy, and I'm just singing. I mean, this is a crazy scene. You know,
reminds me of that scene from the Blues Brothers when they're playing at that bar and all the people are throwing the beer bottles at the chicken wire in front of the stage, and they're just playing, just keep playing and keep singing. That's David.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's fairly, and it's, yeah, and as you were saying, Saul probably ringing in his ears is this, you know, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands, and then he says, I'll show you something. Let me add one to the people that I've slain. It'll be this guy.
Right. Yeah. By the way, Saul must be really bad aim with his spear. You know, this happens more than once where he's obviously in pretty close quarters with David. I mean, they're in the house and he misses him.
Either that or David is very elusive.
Yeah. He must be pretty quick. I mean, he's got a harp in his hand. He's got to get out of the way of the spear that's being hurled toward him.
I mean, how about twice? I mean, like, by the way, after this happened once, I'd be like, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the first time my father-in-law or future father-in-law threw a spear at me, yeah, I think I'd pretty much be out of the house for good. I wouldn't be coming back for more target practice. And then you would think the next verse would say something like, so David was afraid of Saul. But yeah. It's the exact opposite. It says, now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him and had departed from Saul. So, I mean, that gives us the reason, of course. I mean, the reason all of this is happening is not just that Saul is kind of losing his mind. The reason all this is happening is because of the story that we've been following these last few podcasts about how Saul kept rebelling against the Lord and Samuel was there to rebuke him. And Saul begins to realize that everything is just slipping out of his hands. He's losing the kingdom. He's already lost the kingdom, basically. It just remains to be seen. And all of this begins to affect him. God takes his Holy Spirit away from Saul, and an evil spirit from God begins to torment him. So this is what we're witnessing is the gradual decimation of Saul. It's just going to take a while. So Saul is going to die at the end of this book, but he really dies way before that final battle. He's just kind of falling apart at the seams as we work our way story through story. Anyway, back to verse 13, it says, "Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people." That went out and came in, by the way, is kind of technical military terminology in the Hebrew, where if someone goes out and comes in, that just means that they're the ones who are leading the charge, more or less. They're the military commander who goes out before the troops and then brings them back home. And it says, "David was prospering in all his ways because the Lord was with him." I think I pointed out last podcast that those two phrases, either prospering or having success, and then the phrase, "the Lord was with him," both of those are lifted from the Joseph narrative. So this is one more example of how, in this particular chapter, David is treated as sort of a Joseph-type figure who is under threat, but even while under threat, is acting wisely, having success, prospering. And the reason is, same reason for David as the same reason for Joseph, because the Lord is with him. The Lord is on his side.
It does seem that Saul has sent David out. Once Saul becomes this suspicious of David, that David's sort of ability to soothe him has waned. Saul's sort of no longer able to hear from David. And maybe even in a moment of clarity, he decides he's going to send him out because he'd rather do that than kill him. But then he has other moments where he's going to want to kill him again. Saul is a very conflicted person here. He could just, I suppose, command him to be imprisoned or something like that. He doesn't do that. You do see sort of God at work where, why does Saul put him in command of armies? Why doesn't he just get rid of him? We see numerous times where he changes his mind and does want to get rid of him and all this kind of stuff. So this sort of psychological breakdown that Saul is having is sort of all over the text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there'll be a point in the next chapter where Jonathan talks with him, and it almost seems as if he talks some rationality, some reason into him. Like he finally gets it, and he's like, "Oh yeah, okay. I see what David has done for me, and so I won't kill him." It's like Jonathan's able to get through to him. And then the very next scene, he just falls apart again. So he does seem to have these moments of clarity where he realizes what the best option would be, the best action would be, but it's always temporary. The next scene, he's falling apart again.
Yeah, we'll see in the next verse that, you know, as Saul sees that the success of David, it says that he stands in fearful awe of him, right? Yeah. So Saul also has this battle going on within him where he very much hates David. He's very much afraid of David. He also knows that the Lord is with David and not with him. And this is all sort of there's this weird concoction of fear of both David and God mixed with hatred and suspicion of David and no doubt envy of David. This is a very toxic thing that's floating around in the head of Saul.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just going to grow as time goes on. Yeah. So he dreaded him. He stood in fearful awe of him. And then we have the contrast in the next verse. All Israel and Judah loved David. So this is another one of those verses in this chapter that I pointed out last time where everybody loves David. So Jonathan loved David as himself in verse 1. And then it repeats that in verse 3, that he loved them as himself. Now all Israel and Judah loved David. We'll see in the story we're about to get into that one of Saul's daughters loved David. So it's like everybody except Saul loves David at this point. Okay, so let's pick up with the next section, verse 17 and following. We're going to get to a couple of marriage possibilities. If you remember back in chapter 17, one of the promises that was made to the one who would slay Goliath would be that his family would be freed from any kind of taxation and that he would be given the hand of the king's daughter in marriage. So verse 17 says that Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merav. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles." Now, it might seem, if you just look at those words, as if Saul is trying to kind of be on the up and up here, right?
Yeah, Saul's coming around.
Yeah, he's coming around. I mean, I promised this to the victor on the battlefield, and so I'm going to follow through. I'm going to give you my daughter, and all I'm asking is that you continue to fight the Lord's fight, right? Just to fight the Lord's battles and kill those Philistines. Well, this is a great example of where words say one thing and thoughts and motives say something entirely opposite. Because the verse ends by saying this, "For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but the hand of the Philistines will be against him." So he's just looking basically to let the Philistines throw their own spears at David instead of him throwing his spear at David.
Now you know where David got the idea to get rid of Uriah from. He's like, I didn't remember this move being made on me where it didn't work out. But it's not a bad move if you're trying to get rid of someone.
Yeah, years ago in the margin of my Bible, I wrote, I don't even remember writing this, but I said, "As David did later with Uriah."
Yeah.
So, yeah, he learned. There's some interesting parallels here. Actually, we'll see some more of these as we go through here between some of Saul's actions and then what David did later on. It's an instructive example, you know, for people who say, "Well, I would never do blank, whatever it might be," or they criticize someone for doing something. Well, you know, That's fine, but always maintain vigilance and humility, because you never know what your future might hold. And we've all had cases where we imitated someone that earlier we had criticized. Anyway, that's exactly what he's going to do later, as you say, with Uriah. It doesn't work out because David says to the king, "Who am I? I mean, I'm basically nobody, and my father's family, my kin, they're in Israel. I mean, that we're not a family, and I'm not a man that is deserving to be the king's son-in-law." Now, whether this was almost kind of an expected sort of humility, you know, like, you know, if the king offers you something, you're almost obligated to say, no, I'm unworthy of that. Whether this was kind of that kind of formality, or whether it was, you know, heartfelt, or maybe a combination of both, whatever the reason is, it didn't work out. So even though he had, as it were, earned that particular right on the battlefield, he did not take it. So instead of David marrying her, she was married to a guy named Adriel, the Maholathite. They'll come up again much later, the 21st chapter of 2 Samuel. We have kind of a troubling story about the children that are connected with this particular couple. We'll get to that much later on. But anyway, she's married to this other guy.
Well, there's also the possibility, I suppose, that, you know, Saul rolls up and maybe you have a Leah and Rachel situation here, and Saul says, "Hey, I'm give you my oldest daughter to be your wife," and maybe that's just not the daughter that David's into.
Yeah, that's right.
So David's like, "Oh no, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that."
Yeah, he doesn't seem to be too much opposed to the second option, does he?
No. So it might just be these, you know, this is a, you know, first daughter's got to get married off first, and David's like, "Hey, hit me back when that happens, because that's not yeah. I'm gonna wait this one out."
Yeah. Give me a call when McCall is ready to be wed. And she's the one who comes up in the next verse. So now Michal or however you want to say her name, Saul's daughter, loved David. Now, little interesting bit of trivia. I learned this recently. Dan, you might have already known this. This is the only example in the whole Bible, or at least the whole Old Testament. I don't know about the New Testament, but the only example in the Old Testament where it is explicitly said that a woman loved a man, which I find quite interesting.
This is the only,
this is the only example that we have where it says a particular woman loved a particular man. Now, of course, I'm not saying there weren't examples where that happened, but this is the only case where it's actually stated that way. So she loved David. Now, we don't know exactly how David felt toward her. I mean, presumably he loved her too. We're never told that. We do find out later on that these two had a bit of a rocky relationship. We'll find that out a little bit later on, actually much later on, when David is bringing the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. But anyway, she loves David, and you know, word got around, and it got back to Saul. And so Saul came up with a plan. Saul says to himself, I will give her to him that that she may become a snare to him. So this is the father-in-law, future father-in-law, plotting against his son-in-law already. So I'm going to make her become a snare to him, that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul says to David, I'm going to give you a second chance, all right? Second chance to be my son-in-law. So Saul commands his servants, and he says to them to talk to David in private, talk to him secretly, and say, listen, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. You think David actually believed that? I mean, maybe the second part, but like the king delights in you? It seems a bit of a stretch. This is the guy that just tried to pin me to the wall twice with his spear.
Listen, as a guy with a daughter, you have to have a special sort of hatred for someone to be like, I'll use my daughter as bait.
Yeah.
That's some next level paranoia.
Yeah. 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 That, and I mean, of course, we'll see in the next chapter when he confronts her because he expected her to actually help orchestrate the death of David as well.
Yeah.
So, their relationship is pretty strained, I guess, would be one mild way to put it. But yeah, I mean, this is a whole next level. I'm going to use my daughter in order to get revenge against my enemy. Now, we're not exactly sure what he meant by she may become a snare to him. I assume it has to do with the dowry that he's about to propose. We do find out, though, interestingly, that I don't know if it was maybe the servants or maybe it was her, but there is an idol that she keeps in her house that we're going to encounter in chapter 19. So maybe part of what Saul was thinking was she has become a snare to him because she kind of has this side thing going on with idolatry, because she has this idol that she hides in the bed and masquerades as David. But whatever Saul is thinking, he wants to use her to become this trap to ensnare David. So Saul sends the messengers, and they say what they're given to say to David. And the servant spoke these words to David, and David says, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed? So once more, David is showing some deference here. He's like, hey, this is a big deal, right? If I'm expected to be the son-in-law, the king's son-in-law, then I have to have some sort of worthiness. But I'm a poor man, I'm lightly esteemed, I'm unworthy of this. So the servants report this back to Saul. And Saul says, all right, here's the plan. Here's what you are to say to David. The king does not desire any dowry except this, 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now Saul planned, it adds after that, now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. This has got to be the weirdest dowry in the history of humanity.
This sounds suspicious from the jump. If I'm in this situation, I'm like, wait, what? And this is an interesting way to try to get rid of David. So Saul's like, if this guy goes out there and engages in 100 combats with Philistines, surely he's not going to go 100-0. Against this, right? Like, surely, somewhere along the way, surely he's going to get bested. Of course, this does not happen. Spoiler alert. But yeah, but this is a strange thing. Like, I just delight in you. I love you so much. I'm desperate to be your, I so need you to be my son-in-law. I'm gonna need 100 foreskins.
Yeah, all I need you to do is this one thing. I just need to kill 100 men, and then yeah, we'll plan the marriage. We'll send out the save the date cards. Everything will be good to go.
It's just a weird thing. I mean, can you imagine if someone was like, you received a message and someone was just gushing about how much they loved you and how great you were and how everyone loved you, and they just really wanted you to be part of their family, and then put some outrageous request in there too. And to make that happen, I'm going to need you to do this. And it's just something that no one's ever heard of before. And you're like,
the weirdness of it too.
What's going on here?
He has the same, bring me back 100 thumbs or something. I mean, just the very, why that, you know, why of 100 ears? I mean, anything. But
I guess this is, this is how you know that he didn't go around and just, you know, raid Jewish graveyards or something like that, because there's no foreskins in those graveyards. I guess with foreskins, you know, they have to be Philistines.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, they are the uncircumcised Philistines, as they're commonly called. So anyway, that's the weird situation we got going on here. And verse 26, the servants, they go tell David, and David he's happy about this. He's pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. So before the days were up, David went out, he and his men, and, you know, he thought, well, okay, 100, that's, I think we need a few more than that. You know, let's go for 200. So he struck down 200 among the Philistines. You know, David's always up for a challenge. And David brought their foreskins and then gave them in full number to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. I'm just kind of imagining David like dumping out this bucket of foreskins in front of Saul so he could count them if he's really into it. But he pays the bride price, he pays the dowry. And so Saul, I mean, what's he going to say at this point, right? He's not going to say, no, I need 100 more. So he gave Michal, his daughter, for a wife. And then it says, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. And so Saul was David's enemy continually. And then we wrap the chapter, verse 30. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely, there's that verb again, than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed. Got a good contrast there. David says in verse 23, he's a poor man and lightly esteemed. And then we get to the end of the chapter, verse 30, and his name now is highly esteemed.
You have to know that kind of stuff irks Saul too. Like when David's like, oh no, I couldn't, I'm just a poor man and I'm lowly and not held in high esteem, so I could never come into your family. And I don't think that David's trolling him really, but if you're Saul, you're like, yeah, dude, I've heard the songs in the streets. Yeah. Come on.
Right. Yeah. I know what other girls are saying about you. Yeah.
The humility of David is nice, but also, come on.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know the Goliath thing is like going down into Hebrew lore, but you know, I'm just a regular guy. You know, just a regular guy who kills giants with a slingshot.
Yeah, David's having more than like his 15 minutes of fame. You know, His reputation, I'm sure, has spread all over Israel by this point. And, you know, looking at things from Saul's perspective, it was bad enough when all of this other stuff happened. But now David has married into his family. And so his pathway to power, his pathway to the throne, has become even clearer because now he's actually part of the king's family. So we'll see what happens next. Jump into chapter 19. This is the episode I referred to earlier where Jonathan and Saul, his dad, they have a bit of a conversation about David. It says, Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. So there's no subterfuge anymore. I mean, there's no like, you know, kind of clandestine plans about how they're going to take David out by one means or another. Now Saul is just open about his desire. He tells Jonathan, he tells his servants, hey, I want David dead. But it says Jonathan, as we already know, Jonathan greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan kind of, you know, he works out this plan with David. He says, listen, verse 2, my dad is wanting to put you to death. So be on your guard in the morning. I want you to hide in this secret place. And then I'm going to go out and I'm going to stand by my father in the field where you are, presumably close to where you are, so he could overhear the conversation. And then I'm going to speak with my father about you. And if I find out anything, then I'll let you know. So David's going to hide himself, and somehow Jonathan is going to get Saul out there, going to have this little tete-a-tete, this conversation. And so Jonathan spoke well of David to his father. Verse 4, he said to him, don't let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For, now he's going to kind of list some reasons here, because he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. So why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? I mean, it sounds like a pretty good argument to me, right? I mean, if anything's going to kind of get through to Saul, then he kind of lays it all out there. Listen, why would you want to do this? I mean, he hasn't done anything at all against you, and which is true. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that David has done to make Saul think I need to get revenge, or to make Saul think that David is out to get him. I mean, all of this is just kind of in Saul's head. David hasn't actually done anything or said anything that has provoked Saul. It's all self-provoked.
Well, this argument is extremely easy to make because it's so obvious. It's like obviously true, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no reason for Saul to be wanting to kill David. David hasn't done anything. So this what makes this argument difficult is you're making this argument to a crazy person.
Yes, yeah, this is true.
Argument itself is rock solid, and you don't need to be some great orator to make this argument at all. This argument is like plain as day to probably anybody who heard this message that they should go and kill David. The big rub here is that Saul is not right in the head, and so you are trying to persuade somebody who is not thinking clearly. Because if he was thinking clearly, he wouldn't be contemplating such things at all.
Yeah, yeah. And even quotes Saul's own words against him. If you remember back in chapter 11, this is right after we meet Saul for the first time, and the Ammonites. You remember the Ammonites? They besiege that city, and they're like, the people of the city are like, make a covenant with us, and like, yeah, sure, we will if you'll like send out all your guys. We're gonna gouge out all their right eyes, and then they send throughout all Israel for someone to save them, and Saul gathers his men and he saves them, and then at the end of the battle, some of Saul's troops are like, hey, who are those guys who were saying that you shouldn't reign over us? Let's come out and let's bring them out and execute them. Well, at that point, Saul says this. He says, no, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. So Saul said that. And now Jonathan says to Saul, the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel through David. So Jonathan is saying, listen, you yourself way back would not put those guys to death because you saw that the Lord accomplished a great redemption. Well, same thing happened here with David. He took out the Philistine giant. The Lord accomplished great deliverance through him. So don't do it. So anyway, what is Saul going to say? Well, verse 6 says that he actually listened. He listened to Jonathan, and he made a vow. He says, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. So Jonathan calls David. Jonathan told him everything that he had said. Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. You think Saul was like being honest about this? Do you think he actually was truthful in this vow?
He does not live up to this particular vow. I mean, I guess David does not get put to death, but not for lack of trying.
And he tries to.
In my reading of it, I think, like I said, like Saul has these moments of clarity. And I think that probably he's listened to the argument and he thinks it makes sense. I think Saul went in his right mind. I think he then means this to be the case. But what he can't account for, Saul is a man who is not in control, not just his emotions, but also his thought processes and his rage. He's not in control of these things. And so we'll see very quickly, it will only take one thing, a good thing even, before Saul is snapped again. It's sort of, you talk so sense into somebody, but then something happens and that sense has left on the heels of another situation. So yeah, I think that he's probably sincere in the moment. I don't think he means to lie to Jonathan, nor do I think he means to take an oath that he has every intention of breaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I saw a couple of commentators that read this with suspicion, but I think it's best read straightforward. He's in his right mind momentarily, and so he sees the logic of Jonathan's argument and says, yeah, you know, you're right. It would be bad. It would be a sin. It would be actually even in my own best interest to not harm David. And so I will make this vow not to put him to death.
And I think one of the most persuasive parts of this argument is the part where Jonathan is pointing out what should be obvious, that David has made no plays for your crown. He has made no moves to try to dethrone you or replace. He has shown nothing. There has been no aggressive moves on the part of David. He's done nothing but just served you and done whatever you've asked. And so this, if you are temporarily in your right mind, this should speak to you in a way that says, yeah, this suspicion I have is not well-founded. There's I can't point to anything where it's like, well, I'm suspicious of him because he did this or he did this other thing. This part of the argument is pretty solid if you're trying to talk to someone like, why exactly, Dad, are you suspicious of him? He's only done good for you. It's kind of crazy that you would be so suspicious that he wants your position. He's done nothing that would imply that.
Yeah, if David had wanted to stage a coup at some point, I don't think it would have been very difficult for him to actually to take control of the kingdom. But as he has demonstrated, and as he will demonstrate over and over in the chapters that follow, he goes out of his way to avoid bringing any harm to Saul. But we are out of time, so I guess we're going to get to more spear throwing and a little bit of a household idol hiding and some other good stuff in the rest of the chapter.
More Philistines got to die. I'll tell you what, I don't know, but David is trying to rival Samson for greatest Philistine slayer of all time. He's got the Philistines number.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be back next week for all of that. We'll see you then, Chad.
All right. See you then.